Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And this week we're joined by Corey Zhu, who has a long history with Django, does SAS Pegasus, works at Damagi, has a JavaScript series. So we're going to dive into all that. Welcome, Corey.
Hello. Happy to be here.
Thanks for going on.
So maybe we could quickly start. What's your backstory getting into Django? And then we'd love to talk about these projects and a lot of the modern Django that you've been doing and teaching others.
Yeah, sure. I studied computer science in university, but didn't actually touch Python or Django until I sort of entered the workforce and around maybe, I don't know when it was, maybe like 2009 is maybe when I started using Django for the first time.
Do you recall what was the impetus for Python and Django? Was it something work related, or was it on your own sort of projects you thought it might be a good solution?
Yeah, it was work related. So my company Damagi, we do like healthcare-ish solutions primarily for emerging markets. So we do like a lot of work in Africa and other places. At the time, we were doing a lot of .NET development and building these actual like clinical systems for health record systems for the country of Zambia was the thing that I was working on a lot. And when we moved to more web applications, we were kind of evaluating the landscape and we're really torn about whether to choose Django or Rails, which was the other sort of like popular thing that people were using. And Django was a little newer and it was a little bit sort of unproven. But we had a few people on the team who were really bullish on it and were kind of, you know, preaching the Python gospel. And they were like, this is the right decision. And so it was actually sort of like a relatively snap, you know, we debated it for a few days or maybe a few weeks, but a relatively quick decision that sort of like, you know, drastically changed the course of my professional development, I suppose, or my career.
It's nice that Django's there in that story is the new hotness, you know, because Django now is the old stage.
I know.
You know, are we going to use X, Y, Z? No, we'll use Django. But, you know.
Yeah. Now it's the boring technology.
Yeah.
But I think web frameworks are a little bit boring these days, which is a good thing. I mean, it's a lot of it is data science and there hasn't been, I mean, there's Fast API, there's Falcon, like there's still some stuff, or was it, oh, not Falcon, Phoenix. Been watching that Marvel show. But there's less excitement on web frameworks, I think, in general, as opposed to like the Python itself and the ecosystem.
Yeah.
But in any case, I wonder, what do you think
I was
going to
say,
that,
maybe
Corey?
Except in the JavaScript world, I feel like things are still, I still feel like I have a hard time keeping up with you know, everything that continues to happen in the JavaScript world.
Yeah, but that's the overwhelming.
It's still kind of pre-Cambrian, not, right?
Not
yeah,
being
it's
able
true.
To keep up.
Like there's not, you're saying there's not sort of like a Django of JavaScript yet or a Rails.
I don't think so. I don't think there's a battery. I mean, there's a whole bunch of micro frameworks and there's Express, but I don't think there's a Rails Django equivalent at any scale.
No, agreed. Not that I've found or at least not one that everybody agrees on.
Yeah, right.
Right. Well, so I wonder how much Python, because you went to MIT and, you know, being based in Boston as I am, Python seems pretty common here. Whereas when I was out in San Francisco around 2010, it was all Rails, all Ruby, all JavaScript. So I don't know I wonder how much is Python was already kind of embedded in MIT, I think was one of the first to switch over to it for undergraduate teaching.
It was.
Maybe it was after you left though.
Yeah,
if you didn't,
it was after my time.
I, yourself.
I did the old intro CS class in Scheme and Lisp, which, you know, when they switched to Python, we were like, oh, these guys, they have it easy now. We were the ones walking uphill, you know, to school both directions and matching our brackets all the time. I learned Python and Django at the same time. And so Django was really my first exposure to Python. And for a long time, I didn't even really know the difference that well. Like I didn't know when I was using a Django thing versus using a Python thing because it was all new to me.
I had a similar experience that, you know, I had the Django book and I was, you know, using that. And then, but you know, what's this Python? You know, I mean, what are the deeper bits? And then there was a book, what was it called? Pro Django Development or something like that. And it was awesome because the first chapter was like this kind of, from a Django perspective, this tour through the Python data model and through descriptors and, you know, all these bits and bobs that how Python works. And it's like, ah, yeah, that's Python. You know, it's, that was a real eye opener.
I should add that. I'm still working on the updates to my Django books. And that's one of the big things is thinking like, should I have a chapter on just the basics that you need for Django? Probably. Cause I mean, you kind of need to know classes and mix-ins, and even if it's a little bit of a flyby, just sort of saying, instead of saying like, you should know a little bit, saying like, let me just show you some stuff. And as long as that's good, we can continue. But otherwise you might want to go brush up on your Python.
Yeah. That makes sense to me.
More work.
As someone who learned a lot on the job and often kind of followed patterns that I didn't really understand. And then sometimes they got me into trouble. I think having that small amount of foundation to just sort of orient you is often really useful and like underdone sometimes if you're just trying to ship something or, you know, get something out the door.
All right. Maybe I'll add that chapter after all based on this. But so Damagi is really interesting. We were talking about this before we went on the air. So I've visited there for a Django Boston talk, and it's been, I mean, as you say, it's doing healthcare, but enabling, you know, digital healthcare in countries that are using paper or whatever before. So it's making huge advancements in public health, but it's been around since 2000, you know, before 2006, right? Because healthcare is kind of hot now, but Damagi's been there the whole time, right? So I guess I'm curious, what was it like in, you know, 2006, 2007, and because that whole landscape feels very different than what it is today.
Yeah, in a way, we were like way, way ahead of our time. And like one of our founders, his basic idea was, you know, there were these rural health workers in, you know, in places like India he thought that they could have a job aid that would, you know, help them, you know, triage patients, ask questions, do checklists and sort of like make the quality of those care visits better and serve as like a data system. But at the time, like even smartphones didn't really exist. And even sort of like those candy bar Nokia phones were like, you know, not that common in places like that. And so we started on these PDAs, like if you remember, like a Palm Tilot type of thing. And anyway, so that was one of the very early projects that we did. And they didn't really work that well, just because the hardware and the ecosystem wasn't up to speed. And then we diverged into doing sort of medical record systems and stuff in clinics for a while. And then sort of once the technology landscape had matured enough and the hardware had caught up and feature phones, I guess is what we called them, but like those like old Nokia candy bar type phones, and then smartphones came in, then it became possible to really like equip those rural health workers with a device that could handle everything that they wanted to do. And so that's, you know, sort of 5 to 7 years after we started was when we really started seeing successful projects and starting to scale up kind of around the world.
That's really interesting, because a lot of the infrastructure that we had in, you know, Europe, say Western Europe, it's just not there. And so you read a lot about the jump straight to mobile technology in developing countries.
Yeah. Yeah. And connectivity also, you know, is, as Will asked, is an issue, there. And so we built the whole thing to be able to be fully offline whenever you didn't have a connection. And then sort of do sort of like a best effort synchronization whenever it was able to get data. And so in the early days, especially, and even today in many parts of the world, it was common for someone to sort of like, you know, use their phone, use their app for a week, you know, visit a bunch of patients and then go stand on top of a hill, you know, the one place within, you know, 10 miles that actually gets service and sync up all their data and everything else. And then, you know, come back and do it for another week. But so that was certainly a big and continues to be a big design constraint and a challenge with the applications that we build.
So I guess the back end has been Django from the beginning, but then the front ends switching and the different local storages, that's obviously changed a lot more as phones have developed. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's right. It's actually only really been two big, I guess three. There used to be an old like Nokia backend, and then there was an Android backend, which is the most common one. And now there's a web version, which also serves as like an online only iPhone client.
Can I ask about that client? Cause I'm interested in this, but how do you deal if it's web-based, if it's in the browser, how do you deal with storage being kind of trying, because you've got local storage, but that kind of gets deleted behind your back without you really knowing about it or being able to do anything about it.
Yeah, the browser version is online only. We assume if you've got a laptop, if you've got a browser, then you've probably got an internet connection.
And are you, is it Postgres? Like just you know, this is a technical podcast, so we can dive in a little deeper than most folks do.
Mostly Postgres these days. We make this product platform called ComCare, and it's actually it's an application builder for these mobile apps. And so you can kind of think of it like a Webflow or like a Squarespace, but for like mobile applications that end up on a phone. Because our users are defining their own schemas, like they can pick whatever questions they want to ask. They can, you know, choose whatever data models, how they want to like update the fields and validation. So it's basically all of our data is completely schemaless. And again, going back to 2008 or whenever, when we were first designing and building this thing, NoSQL was all the rage, and PostgreSQL support wasn't really there yet. So we actually made probably one of the biggest technology miss decisions, maybe the biggest one, which ultimately is on my shoulders. But so a lot of our data was in CouchDB, and some of it still is in CouchDB. But we are doing our best to move away from CouchDB and into Postgres.
But that's kind of sad because CouchDB was cool. Like, I mean, you know, it did all the schemaless thing. It had the REST API just there. It did the sync. CouchDB, which would work in the browser and would sync to it, like, which got to suit your use case, one would think. Like, why was it
cool.
a disaster?
No, it was it was super cool. And it worked really well for that sync thing. Worked really well for certain types of applications that we built, where it would just kind of magically handle the syncing for us. But at scale, it has really become a problem. I mean, at our current app, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but like, you know, we've got order of magnitude like, you know, hundreds of servers, including like, you know, like. It, certainly two-digit numbers of database servers. And at that scale, we've had some issues with CouchDB. And like when something goes wrong with CouchDB, it's not as easy to fix it and troubleshoot it and everything else, just because it's, you know, the adoption isn't there.
Okay. And so is the solution now Postgres? Is that the way you go, or do you favor something else?
Pretty much, yeah. Any sort of structured data.
Got it. So you were at Damagi for quite a while, and then 2017, right? You made the leap into self-employment, right? You're sort of at a hybrid situation now, but yeah, I'm curious, what was the motivation for that? And then let's talk about your various projects, because you've been doing the, you know, out in the wilderness thing for not as long as I have, but almost as long.
How long have you been doing it?
Well, if I'm honest about it, 7-8 years at this point. I mean, yes. I worked at some startups along the way, but nothing that either got traction or I was an integral part of. So the last 5 years, it's been my own show.
Okay, nice.
I said also before we got on, you have a newsletter writing about kind of your journey, and so many of those things resonate with me, you know, the up months, the down months, you know, trying to find reason to equate why sales are up or down, and you know, all that rings so true, right? I find just the highs are higher and the lows are so much
totally.
Lower doing your own thing, because it's just you.
yeah, totally.
Because I'm just sort of sanguine about all of it. Like, I don't even look at sales on any regular basis. I don't look at my analytics more than every month or
wow.
two. So
that's a
because it just as you
that's an impressive level of zen.
Yeah, zen or being overwhelmed by, you know, little kids, but it doesn't change anything is what I realize, right? As long as there isn't a massive spike, there's very little of my day-to-day input that changes the output. And but it's irresistible when you go to do your own thing to see, you know, day by day, minute by minute, you know, sales or analytics, right? It feels so good. But the problem is you sort of attach yourself to the good and the bad, or at least I did.
Yeah, for sure. No, I think that's I think everyone struggles with that. And yeah. But anyway, so basically going back to your question, like I don't know if I said this, but so I was the CTO of Domagi during sort of this period, 2007 to 2017 or so. And by the time I decided to step down, you know, the technology part of the org was like 30 people. At one point I probably had 15 direct reports, and it was like, I was both burnt out and doing a bunch of sort of like work that I didn't love. Like I think of myself as a builder or a maker. And I found myself doing lots of, you know, HRE management-y type things. And so I was just like, okay, I need a break. And then it was, so I decided to go on a 6-month sabbatical. And then, in the first couple of weeks, I was like, well, like, what am I going to do? Because I'm not the type of person who just like sits on a beach either. You know, like I like to stay busy. And so I was like, well, and it was right around the same time that I started reading articles on indie hackers about these people who were sort of like running these small businesses and, you know, making, you know, tens of thousands of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars, like, you know, work
and living on a beach.
Yeah. Like, and doing crazy stuff too. Like, you know, like selling candies from Japan or like, I don't know, there was a ton of cool stories. And I was like, well, like I'm, you know, I can build apps. Like maybe I'll try to figure this out. And so, but I was very unambitious in my plan. So I was like, well, let's just see if I can make a dollar just like selling something online. So I tried to pick something that was, you know, quite easy and likely to be able to make a dollar. And so the first thing I tried was this, it was a product called PlaceCardMe, which is, I still feel silly to this day talking about it. And the fact that I still, run it and it's made me like, you know, $50,000 is crazy. But it's basically like you just upload a spreadsheet of names and table numbers for like a wedding. And then it creates a PDF file that like lays them out in, the layout of like place cards, which are these things that you can like put on tables to tell people where they're sitting. And then, you know, people can download them, they can print them out, they can cut them up and put them, on tables for weddings and events.
That's super. Yeah, so
no, that's super. That's, you know, that's a real problem.
So that's a dollar to do that.
It was free for a very long time.
Charge more.
I know. Yeah, it's still free if you are willing to tolerate a little bit of branding on the cards.
Okay.
But yeah, now it's $8.
Okay.
For sort of like a set of cards, as many as you want.
But that's brilliant, right?
Now, is that something that, I mean, I guess all three of us are married. So is that something that there's like this wedding industrial complex and there's all these like Squarespace for wedding sites. Is that something that they didn't have at the time, or have they built that in? Because that seems like a good idea. They might come to you and say, we'd like to buy that, or else they just copy it.
Yeah, it's not something that I had seen in the wedding industrial complex. It's more common in print shops, like a company that, you know, prints photos and photo books or something like that. They might have the ability to do something like this. But yeah, like I wanted something that was super quick and easy, and like we would have used it for our own wedding if we had found it. And so that was like the seed of the idea. Was like, I was sitting there, my wife ended up on the night before our wedding, or two nights before our wedding, like sitting around with a bunch of her friends and writing these things by hand.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, I saw other people just kind of typing the names into to like a Microsoft Word document or something like that. And I was like, it's crazy that this is not a solved problem.
Well, there's two extremes, right? I've seen some weddings where they hire a calligrapher to do, you know, everyone's name, and then there's more of DIY. Or in my wedding, we just had like a buffet.
Nice.
Because we'd been to enough weddings and seen, you know, it's like you get married, you're like, I'm going to keep it simple, I'm going to keep it small. And it just is so much more complex and so much bigger than you think it is. Like even things like, I didn't think about the fact that everyone is a plus one or just like cousins and stuff, right? So I was like, well, I only know 20 people,
right.
You know, 20 plus 20 is 40. But like, no, it's like pretty hard to keep it under 100. Yeah. For most people.
And the entire industry is designed to make you feel bad about not being extravagant enough, you know? And so like, there's all, like, everyone's just trying to one up at each other. And usually all your friends are getting married at the same time. And so you're going to these weddings and everybody's kind of like, ooh, did you see the centerpieces? And like, it's a vicious thing.
Yeah. No, that's a great idea. That reminds me, and maybe you're inspired by, what's his name? Is it Patrick? Who's at Stripe now, who has the like the Jeopardy game for teachers?
Bingo card maker, right? Yeah.
Is that what?
I actually didn't find out about him until later on after I'd already kind of gone down the road of the place card thing. But I do sometimes fashion myself as like oddly sort of following his career in sort of like, you know, on a much smaller scale. but starting with like the paper printable thing and then, you know, sort of stair stepping into products that make more money. And I wonder if I'll eventually end up at Stripe. I wouldn't entirely rule it out, although I don't think it's likely.
So I worked at this company called Quizlet in the education space. And of the initial 10 people, 4 at Stripe. So, and they're 4 of the best people. So,
Yeah.
Partly because we were like, our founder was roommates with one of the early Stripe engineers, and their office was next door. And you know, it's like if there's this $100 billion juggernaut next door,
right.
It's not a bad place to go when you're looking to switch things up.
Yeah, it makes sense.
But anyway, so those next things, because you've got SAS Pegasus, which is the Django boilerplate. You have this modern JavaScript series. Carlton looks like he wants to say something.
This is what I want to hit you up about, because I saw you tweeting about your SAS Pegasus, which is just it's great, and the way you do it and the way you blog about how it's going, and you know, I love that. So can you talk about those products? And
so the place card thing, like after I did that and I kind of started to get bored of it, and I was like, okay, I should do a new thing. And then I was like, it's like all this code that I have to like redo. And so I kind of like copied the place card repository into like a new thing and then started editing stuff. And I kind of realized like, oh, there's like, this should be like, there should be a product that gives you a clean starting point to like build sort of like a generic web application or SaaS application. That's like, you know, Django's an incredible foundation. I love it. I think we all probably love it on this conversation. But it's, I think of it as like a, like it's not being opinionated about your own model, like how you, do users and that stuff, how you structure your project, how you, do like UI stuff. And so I wanted to produce something that would provide, a more fully featured version of Django that has a lot more, even more batteries included, I suppose. And then sell that as a template for other people to, you know, use to build and launch their own product ideas, super quickly. So that was kind of that was the genesis of the idea. And I will say like, it wasn't a completely like novel idea. Like there were other products in other frameworks. There's something called Laravel Spark, for Laravel PHP. And then, there's a handful in the Rails ecosystem. I looked around, I think, and I feel a little weird, talking about this, but like, I think something about the Python Django community is, they're so sort of like pro open source and in some ways like not like great business people. Or like, I don't know if that's right, but like, I feel like the type of person who uses Python and Django is often like, you know, an open source developer who's you know, like the idea of making money, like it's sort of even built into like some of the Django code of, I forget, William, what you were calling it, but like some of the Django terms is like, you know, we don't want people to like, you know.
Yeah, the Django trademark.
Yeah. But yeah, so anyway, so like there was absolutely nothing in the space for Django as like a commercial product. And so it seemed like a clear gap that was worth filling.
And how long have you been working on it now? Like a year, 2 years, 3 years? Like how long has it been going?
It's a little hard to measure exactly, but I would say I probably broke ground on the code base. Let's see, 3 years ago.
Okay.
About 3 years ago. And it's basically been my full time side gig, which so it's getting half my full time.
Okay.
For the last 2 years.
Okay, super. And then you seem to have everything. So you've got like a bit of, you've got a bit of Bootstrap. You've got a bit of, did you put Tailwind or not? I saw you.
The Tailwind is, experimental.
Okay. And, but you've got like Stripe in there. You've got, I don't know, you know, tell us the bits.
Yeah, exactly. So the idea is like kind of all the pieces that, hopefully you need to build a business. So it's got Stripe for either like one-off payments or for subscriptions. It ships with either Bootstrap or Bulma or experimentally Tailwind. So you can kind of pick your CSS framework. I'm working right now on kind of two versions. One, which is sort of like a classic React Django REST API architecture where you sort of have like the decoupled client server because a lot of people are interested in using that. Versus one that's sort of vanilla Django, models and forms, that type of thing. At the moment it's got, it's kind of a hybrid version. And we might talk about that more if we talk about the modern JavaScript series, but, so at the moment it's kind of got, it's a Django server side rendered application, that also, sprinkles in React in a few different places. And it, so it, if you want to use React, I like that architecture for as a solo developer, and I think it works really well as a solo developer. Although I think for teams, it's often the case that people want, you know, they want to have their front end devs and their back end devs, and they only talk to each other through APIs. And so, so now I'm working on figuring out how to offer that version as well.
I think in a kind of agency or small startup environment, they very much have these silos of, those are the back end people over there and they're locked in that cupboard, and here are the front end people and they're sitting on gym balls and, you know, they're out here socializing with everyone else.
Which is interesting because I've never actually worked at an organization that was structured that way, but maybe it's just, I mean, I've basically mostly worked for Damagi, and maybe people didn't have a sense of how to split things up like that back when we were sort of breaking ground on architecture.
Because so I guess the follow-up then is, you know, how much of your time do you spend on building, you know, features for the boilerplate versus, you know, promoting it and marketing and telling people it's there? Because, you know, you build it, no one buys it. Well, that's because they didn't know about it.
Yeah, no, totally. You know, I try to spend half and half. That's kind of my target. And there's a book by Gabe Weinberg, I think the creator of DuckDuckGo, and somebody else whose name I'm forgetting, called Traction, where they talk a lot about this. And one of the things they say is like, you should probably spend about half your time trying to get traction for your thing and the other half building it and making it better. I think it, probably as you could guess, and maybe as you guys could relate to, it probably skews substantially more towards building. Just because I find the building part to be a lot more fun. And a lot more interesting, but yeah, it's probably closer to like maybe one third, two thirds, one third Traction, two thirds.
You have had
product.
Some luck, right? Cause I've seen you at the top of the Orange site a couple of times, you know?
I have gotten lucky and managed to get a couple articles on Hacker News, I think is what you're referring to.
Yeah.
It's funny because that's...
You have to put a dollar in the pot if you say its name now, so...
But I think it's just the JavaScript articles, right? Where it's like, oh yeah, it's always like, Django exists, and here's JavaScript. That's my sense of Hacker News. Like, I always tease Carlton when he launches a new version of Django. It's like, you know, for like a morning, it's on Hacker News, and it's like all these comments being like, is this still here? You know, and then it's, you know, whatever.
Yeah, people are still using Django.
Yeah, more or less.
Nothing I've written about Django has ever made it on Hacker News. It's all my sort of like...
That's my point, yeah.
Yeah, so I am... you know, maybe too transparent about all the stuff that I'm doing and how much money I'm making and sort of like chronicling. I do these monthly retrospectives where I sort of like say how much money I made and what I was working on and how the month went and stuff like that. And occasionally I will take some learnings from this sort of like solopreneuring journey and try and distill them into something more general. And every once in a while that makes it on Hacker News. But it's the business stuff, not the technical stuff.
Okay. So then one more question on this and then I'll let Will jump in. But if you do get a post on Hacker News, it goes really well and, you know, you get it. Does that actually translate into an increase in signups or increase in sales? Or is it like they come, they see, they crash the server, they go?
Yeah, it's... it does. It not a lot.
Right.
Okay. I think I had... one article that I published around shortly after Black Friday, where I talked about like kind of how I ran a Black Friday sale and my lessons learned from that and stuff. And that did really well on Hacker News and I think led to two or three sales, which is, I mean, you know, it's like that. So the current sale price is $300. So like, you know, $900 is not nothing for an article, although the article probably took me like 20 hours to write and edit. Yeah, so, yeah, yeah. You know, it's like not, you know, I could be, you know, selling my time to big corporations and earning more than that.
Well, I guess at that kind of price range, you are targeting sort of agencies or companies or, you know, people, not necessarily targeting the loan developer.
I think I'm targeting the loan.
I don't know.
Like if I were targeting companies, I'd probably charge.
Well, that's what I was going to.
At least five times that. And I've often thought about experimenting with really big price increases, but I also like having lots of people using it and giving me feedback and stuff. So it's a bit of a trade-off.
That's always the Basecamp folks. What is it? 99? I'm forgetting their name, but they always talk about this, about sort of like the appeal of enterprise. They talk about how they deliberately keep their price low enough so they can tell big companies to go away because they don't want to become custom. But like the reality is, you know, yeah, you have one or two mega users and it's so much, you know, nicer to have one or two users who drive 60% of your sales or whatever.
Yeah.
But there's this like Death Star pull of then you do what they want versus what your general customers do. But it is where all the money is. So it's on any product, I think it's really, really hard to avoid that. I mean, I remember Slack when it went public was like 60% of the revenue was 10 companies, even for Slack. And I think that's probably not uncommon actually for a lot of things, is that even a lot of things that seem like they're very customer focused, the reality is you have a couple big fish who drive, you know, so much. So it's really hard to resist that temptation. It may be, you know, it's not a bad thing to do, but I've felt the same way on some things where I kind of want to do what I think the community wants, but if one or two people are using it and driving a lot of the sales, it's like, well,
yeah, it's
hard to make a judgment on what the right call is.
Totally. I remember the one moments I have had where I was just like, oh, I should be charging more. It's like, there's been maybe two times where someone's email address was like, you know, Alice at like very big company that I've heard a lot about.com. And I'm like, oh, they just paid like $300 and they probably would have paid, you know, many thousands of dollars for this. And, you know, but apart from that, it's.
But they kind of need the hand holding though, right? Like that's the thing, is that at that price range, they expect and normally get a bespoke experience, a dedicated person. And when it's just you, it's hard enough to do marketing, let alone to, you know, adequately give the time to someone spending thousands of dollars on something.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, just to make you feel better. It's sort of like, even if they have, you know, $50,000 to pay for a starter project, there's all this paperwork and all these things involved that, you know, you're probably not set up to deal with. I mean, for whatever amount, you probably could figure it out. But like, I mean, we have the same. So the Django Software Foundation has this issue with grants, like especially we talked to the head of the Python Software Foundation. There's a lot of grants out there for open source, but most of them require like a detailed financial audit and all this extra stuff, you know, rightly so, that the DSF doesn't have the infrastructure to do. Mm. So we sort of can't really get a 5-figure grant because it comes with all these other things.
That's a shame.
So I think there's some analogy there.
Yeah.
I've been watching SaaS Pegasus and really happy that there is a paid product finally, because I share your thoughts that there's something about Python Django. And maybe I've always thought it's make people are a little more advanced in their career. Like a lot of times people who want to build a startup, they go to JavaScript or Rails because they kind of want to make money. Whereas Django and Python is a little either pure or someone's later in their career or they're at a bigger company where they're not as focused on the financials from my experience. So it does make the ecosystem around educational content, starter projects hard. I also think that, you know, because I have a good friend who's a Laravel developer. And so he's always telling me about all the things they're doing there where he's like, yeah, for $100, whatever it is, he's like, he just buys the starter project because he has a lot of clients and it's just, he bills it to the client, saves him time. But my sense is Django is generally, maybe with Wagtail, it's a little different, but it's used for more complicated things, or it's an agency that already kind of has their internal template. Yeah. So they're not, there isn't that like churn. It's not like kind of WordPress with batteries. It's like you go to Django because you want a little bit more. So I've always thought if you couldn't sell into the agencies, you'd have a hard time making it work. So that's why I've been pleased to see that, you know, your project has worked pretty well, because I always just, like I have this project Django X, which is a much more basic Django starter project and it has 1,000 stars, but I didn't really bother doing more with it because I didn't think there was a market there. So I'm glad that there's a market. Like there should be hopefully multiple, you know, successful boilerplates out there.
Yeah, well, I'll begrudgingly accept that, although I won't mind if there's one.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's seriously though, I think it's good for Django that there is a paid one. And yeah, if there's just one, all the better. You know, Laravel is interesting because it's just Taylor, the creator, like he owns the ecosystem of stuff, right? So if you know that if you buy the starter project, it contributes to Laravel. Yeah. Same thing with hosting. Like I sort of look somewhat enviously that it's a dictatorship. He can just totally do stuff and it directly benefits Laravel. You know, Django is open source community. So I'd say it's a little more complicated to add features in the same way as he's able to do.
Yeah.
Right, Carlton? Like, you know, there could be an official Django template, but like who's going to support it? Who's going to do it? Right. I mean, that's the thing is like, it's one thing to do the code, like all the rest that you have to deal with, like doing the updates, marketing it.
Okay, like, but like, okay, so we discussed in, you know, the past, like things like for security releases, there is a pre-notification list and you can apply to get on that if you're, you know, we try and discourage it and, you know, you've got to have a real reason why you need to be on that list. But, you know, there are some big companies on that list and one thought is, well, you know, perhaps we could charge for that. But no, we wouldn't do that because that's charging for access to security that's important that affects everybody. And it's just not, you know, but why couldn't that company pay? That's a giant megacorp. They could pay for that. That wouldn't be a problem. But that's just not how it goes. That's just not how Django is. And, you know, once you go down that road, does it not destroy everything that makes Django special? Because it's not really the frame. I mean, the framework's great. It's awesome and it's wonderful. Yeah. But it's the community and everything that goes with it that makes Django worth hanging around for.
I was going to say in this conversation, I've both wondered if I'm now the destroyer of Django and wondered if the Django Software Foundation is going to compete with me. And both of those are
No.
No one would do it.
I'm joking.
There isn't capacity for that to be done by Django. You know, we wouldn't, just the thought that somehow the DSF would set up a hosting company. Like you know, there was that Rails engine thing that was kind of tied in with Ruby on Rails. Right? It was like, go to the Ruby on Rails site and there was a hosting option sort of top, front and center and back in the day.
Interesting.
Yeah, the DSF, just to assuage any fears, the DSF is so much smaller than maybe if people are even aware of it than think that it is. I mean, the Python Software Foundation has 8 full-time people and all this stuff, but there's a board of 7. We meet once a month. We have regular emails, but it's basically Anna, who's the president, does quite a lot for free. I'm the treasurer. I do a bit. And the secretary does some stuff. And then other people help. But, you know, there's no capacity there. Like, you know, even the Django survey. So last year, we and I kind of led this, had a survey on Django usage, which we hadn't had for a number of years. And, you know, this year we're going to collaborate with JetBrains because JetBrains does it for the Python Software Foundation. Nice. And that's great because it's like, I don't have the time I did last year to do that again, you know, because it's all volunteer. So anyway, so I agree. I think it's part of the specialness, though, of Django. Like, very few people are directly getting paid. And even the fellows that we have, Carlton and Marius, I mean, they're probably making below market. They're definitely making below market rate.
You don't be a fellow because you think, well, you know, that's the highest paid job I can get. No, it's not. You do it for other reasons.
But speaking of your boilerplate, I wanted to ask about Stripe because I've had, and actually Carlton, so we all three of us can talk about Stripe. So Carlton's almost done with adding it to the Django.
Waiting for some things from the board, Will. We'll talk about that.
Oh God.
Yeah, no. So we're updating the Stripe integration. So they changed it all for the European, I don't know, whatever it is, yeah. SCA rules. And so we updated the front end bit, and there's a bit where you manage your subscription where we're still using the old API, and we want to use the hosted Stripe checkout because that will just been so much easier than maintaining the code ourselves and doing all the API hits and, you know, all that stuff, which it's okay. We've got the code there, it works, but to maintain that code has a cost, and it'd be much better if that code just could be deleted.
You're reminding me of that thing, Carlton. I mean, maybe just for anyone who's listening, who's curious how the DSF actually works. So for example, for this new thing, we need to have a privacy policy. Terms of service, which we don't have currently on the Django site because we haven't needed it. So, okay, how do we do that, right? Like, we're Django, we need to do it properly. So we need to have a proper lawyer and have proper thing. You know, we don't have a regular lawyer and we don't have the money to pay a top flight firm. So I've been talking to the Python Software Foundation. I've been talking to, you know, someone at Tidelift, you know, because we want to get someone good, but we want someone who's not going to charge us a lot, or we'll do it pro bono. So it's this whole process just to get that, right? So if you think about what that takes, and that's all in my free time, you know, me and the other board members. And then the idea that we would have, you know, a job site or a starter project, it's just like the madness of thinking that would ever happen is not going to happen.
Yeah. Well, in a way it's also sort of like one of the big reasons why I decided to start going out on my own and sort of like fully owning and controlling everything I do is like, it's inevitable, you know, at an organization of, you know, more than a handful of people that you'll run into consensus building and bureaucracy and these other things. And I'm kind of like an impatient person, I suppose. And so being able to just exactly like be a dictator and make whichever decisions I want and do whatever I want is very satisfying and freeing. And so that's one of the reasons why I love just having my own businesses and why I haven't even like considered sort of like trying to hire anybody or anything like that.
Yeah. You still have all the scar tissue of the cruft of everything else. Well, I mean, and for Django, I mean, so at Quizlet, like I did our first terms of service and copyright. And, you know, I can say this now, you know, I basically like looked at YouTube and changed some words around. That's what all the startups did because it was a startup. So what's the difference? We didn't have money to pay a fancy lawyer, but you know, Django is Django. So we have to, and we'll do it right. But in the context of, you know, we're not Google where you can just have an in-house counsel do it. So, it slows things down, rightly so. But you know, I'm sort of like you, I'm used to just being dictator of my own little world, but, there's reason things slow down in big places.
Just finish that, and then I'm going to say, what did you want to ask Corey about Stripe about? Like, with Django, things always feel like they're moving slowly, but they're kind of inexorable in that, you know, you look back a year and it was like, oh, wow, we've done all of that. And we've, you know, 2 years, all of that happened. 3 years, all of that happened. But any given day, it feels like things are taking a while because it's a big ship, so it takes a long time to turn. But anyway.
I will say the... the effort that Django puts into its release processes and the LTSs and the, you know, the like deprecations and all of that, like I can't imagine how much work and planning that all takes, but it's incredible. It's, I feel like that's an incredible thing that many other frameworks don't get right in the way that Django does.
Oh, cool. Well, thanks. It does. There's a lot goes in. I mean, the processes have been set in place over time, and that's, you know, that really helps. But, you know, every month Maris and I are busy, you know, making sure that train stays smooth, you know? So that's good. Yeah. Thank you. Will, what did you want to ask Corey about Stripe about? Because you mentioned it and then we got distracted.
Oh, we're just having a great fest about changes. And as we all know, Stripe is constantly making changes, I think, which generally improve the product, but it's not always the easiest thing to work with. And I know one of the selling points of SaaS Pegasus is you have integration. So you probably feel you need to keep up with those changes.
I do, although...
Because they still, the old ones still work is the thing, right? They have quite a big deprecation period.
Yeah, but they don't work with new cards sometimes. But like you, I think I suspect that in a future release, Pegasus will just move over to checkout also, just because, just like you, it's like, I don't want to continue to be on this Stripe financial system treadmill. And I think more and more companies are using Stripe Checkout. I think even consumers, and especially like prosumers, like business consumers, are sort of, they know what Stripe is. They're not freaked out if they get redirected to Stripe when they're checking out on, you know, buying a subscription or something. So, and I've talked to my Pegasus customers, and there's a handful of them that they have like the fully bespoke UI that they can customize however they want. But most of them are like, no, checkout's fine. That makes sense. And some of them actually, the majority of them actually prefer checkout, just because then they can sort of be instantly up to date with everything as it comes out.
To continue on Stripe, so I had for a while that I think I guess I still have this top Stripe Django tutorial, which I wrote on this site testdriven.io that my friend Michael Herman does. And so the Stripe team of like five community people emailed me saying, hey, you need to update to the new thing. And there's all these emails. And I was like, you know, the amount you all have gotten paid to email me, to hassle me about this, you could have just done it. So like, I feel like there's sort of a, Stripe is great, but it's like, y'all should just have the Django version of how to do this. You should have the Express version, the Rails version. Like, it's in madness that you're relying on the community to do these things. Because they've got the Flask kind of sort of version. But it's like one day a month, pick one of your engineers just to maintain, you know, the full, you know, integration in like the top four or five frameworks. But I guess, you know, now that they're doing checkout, that kind of goes away. And it does... As we said, like, people are used to that flow, because it used to be scary to be redirected somewhere else, even to PayPal for a transaction. But it's such a pain, it slows things down, because every developer has to update their stuff, and you know, you don't want to get the security stuff wrong around tokens and stuff for financial things.
Yeah.
Anyways, yeah.
I will say, like, the number of financial edge cases that I'm sure that they understand the way, like the different points in the process where a transaction could fail or where an additional authentication step could happen. Like, I think that web of that network of like possible states that things could branch out to is just like terrifying to me. And
I'm too big.
Like, I think the root source of the complexity of their API is that they're attempting to design something that is like resilient to failures in any of those different parts of the process. But it does feel weird and complicated if you're just like, well, I just want to like give you a credit card number and like charge it, you know? I don't want that complexity.
So my friend from Quizlet, who's a manager at Stripe, I don't think this is prep. I can say this. So there's still a Rails monolith, still to this day. But there, which is kind of, you know, to that question of like, do monoliths scale? It's like, well, Stripe's pulling it off, you know, as well as Shopify, but they're switching over to Java because, on top of everything else, they're, you know, they're basically like Google in terms of size, and they've had a big process around how do we upgrade, and they're switching over things to Java, but it's still fundamentally just a REST API is what the company is, right? So
yeah.
So finally, at this stage, they're hitting a limit on what the Rails can do. And also, they've got so many engineers. It's kind of like you need them to do stuff, right? So like, if you can shave some transactions off, it's like, I think there is some truth to that, right? We've all worked on teams. Like, it's really hard to, it's some, you know, you want people to be busy, but it's also like, it's better to be rebuilding the ship all the time than just working on a side thing. Like, there is that temptation.
But, okay.
Yes. Back when I was
learning, there was a thing about scaling, and the advice was this, was like, first of all, be able to scale it, right? So be able to go from one server to two, to three, to four, to five. And then when you've got that down, which like Stripe clearly have, then start worrying about the cost per server, right? So if you can trim off 10 cents here, that doesn't matter at the beginning. Don't bother trimming off 10 cents at the beginning because it's totally pointless. But when you've scaled out, then that 10 cents obviously becomes a lot because, you know, you've multiplied it so many times. So first of all, you know, duplicate your setup at whatever cost and then cut the cost per thing. And Stripe are at that stage now, right? And have been for ages, but they're like, yeah, let's cut the cost here because that will make a massive difference to our bottom line, I would say. Anyway, Corey, I wanted to come swing back to JavaScript and Django. And so you've got this Rails thing, right? This React thing, and that's one way. And then how do you think you're writing it yourself. How would you rig up the front end, the JavaScript to Django integration? What would you go for personally?
Oh, and if I'm writing it for myself, I would definitely I have a whole, series of articles that basically talks about my opinions on this. Although I think they're more general than that, but I would want to use modern JavaScript. I would want to use React where it made sense, like where there was going to be either a stateful or a complexly interactive user interface. And I would want to use Django for all the boring stuff that where there isn't. So like your password reset form or your, yeah, you know, like your account settings page potentially or something like that. And so I like having a, you know, sort of like a quote normal Django project, and then a separate JavaScript like build pipeline that is just taking it's like a standalone JavaScript project, but then the output of that ends up in a bundle file that's served like a normal Django static file.
So inside static, and then from inside the static roots type thing, you collect static,
yeah,
on it. Yeah, yeah,
okay. Yeah, yeah. And I don't know, like I've been doing like that. That was when I first just sat down to make PlaceCardMe. I was like, okay, this is like, I'm going to do this like PlaceCard builder thing where it's like, there's going to be like a lot of complex interaction and I want it to like be modern whatever. So I was like, okay, I'll use React for this. That sounds good. And then like, just like figuring out how to do React inside Django was like not at all clear.
Yeah.
And so I wrestled with it for a lot and then sort of like arrived at this solution of once I wrapped my head around like, oh, all this fancy complicated React build stuff, at the end of the day, it still just produces a JavaScript file and that JavaScript file can run in a browser.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, well, I know how to use JavaScript files in Django. and so like, once I had that sort of like epiphany, then I realized like, oh, this is really straightforward. And I've basically used that architecture for every other project I've worked on to date. And it's always worked really well for me. So I can like move super quick on the Django stuff. That's really easy. And there's forms and there's views and templates, obviously, and all of that works well. And then like reach for React whenever I need to do something complicated. And then I have that sort of access to all that modern JavaScript tooling.
Well, I think you're, so Aymeric Augustine, who's a longtime Django contributor, he also has a series on this. And the last couple of years, anyone who has questions on this, I've referred them to your series and to his. His is a little bit shorter, but
he more or less says similar things. Configure the static file.
Yeah, he says,
tell it where the folder is.
And he says the same thing.
Yes, done.
I think his is maybe a little more of a choose your own adventure, but he, I think, advocates for the same approach. Because, yeah, as you say, like, and I went through the exact same thing. It's like, all the build complexity is just local. It's what you end up serving is a single file. So it's sort of not really Django's fault that that all is complicated.
Yeah, exactly.
But it seems like it is.
I think what people want, though, is some sort of integration with Run Server, right? So you just fire up Run Server but no, you've got to have your JavaScript build watcher in a separate terminal. So you need two tabs for that.
Yeah.
One to watch the JavaScript and one to build.
I know that people do try to do fancy stuff to make JavaScript build things happen in the Django world. And we used to use a project called Django Bower or something where you defined your Bower dependencies in Python. And it kind of sounds nice at first, but then you hit something that doesn't work. And then you're trying to troubleshoot this crazy, it's someone else's implementation of a wrapper around calling a JavaScript. And at the end of the day, I found that a lot of those tools that try to make specifically front-end development, easier in the Django world, they often, they work until they don't. And then once they don't, you're just kind of in a stuck, really tricky situation. And it learning the actual, how to use NPM and Webpack and whatever else is it's not that hard. And then you're using the same tooling that the entire rest of the world is using. And then when you Google something, it's the answer is relevant to you instead of not really being sure where in the stack the thing is failing. So I generally shy away from the type of thing that would try to make React work in Run Server.
Brilliant. Amen. There we are.
Well, I think that's where everyone gets to at a certain point where you appreciate what a third party package does, but unless you really, really need it, it's I'm going to end up rebuilding this anyways, so maybe I'll just peek at the source code and see.
A lot of third-party packages are good for ideas, right? Oh, yeah, that's nice.
There was a time where I was, thinking that Pegasus should have no third-party dependencies, and I would be opinionated about everything, but ultimately I selectively picked a few that seemed like obvious choices, like Allauth and a handful of others. So.
Yeah, you don't want to build that yourself, no.
Yeah, exactly. But it's hard to know where to drop that line, you know? It's is there a certain number of GitHub stars where you're okay, this thing is probably acceptable, or maybe you just have to look at the source, I don't know.
I think in the Django world, if it's been going 10 years or more, it's safe, and anything less than that, you've got to be skeptical.
If Jazz Band is doing it, it's probably okay.
that's a good metric. I like that.
Yeah. Well, there is maybe I'll put in the show notes there on the Django forum, there was this discussion around kind of the top 5 or 10 packages that people use, because I feel like there are a couple. Allauth would be probably the first, one of the first ones I think of that.
And REST framework.
Obviously. You kind of need to use it. and REST framework. but then it does sort of fall off a little bit. But it is an open question, I guess. So I know we're going over on time. I did want to ask one last question, which is deployment, if I could,
because
partly Carlton's been working on button.dev.
I've heard you talk
simpler
about
Django.
I'm getting it. If it wasn't for this crazy pandemic and my kids always being off school with cold, it turned out the kids this week had colds, and we were like, oh no, they've got COVID, and we got them tested and they didn't. It's like, wow, what a way off. So we're so close to getting vaccines, another 2 months we'll all have vaccines and it'll be slightly different world. But it was like, no, we've gone this far without it. And then it was a mega stress. But, bar all of those sorts of things, it's coming on nicely. But yeah, anyway, deployment, go.
Yeah, so just you personally, we don't have time to get into the full deployment, but what do you like using for your personal stuff?
Oh, I have a Linode that I host 6 projects on.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
$20 a month and it works great. Yeah. And I love it. But for Pegasus, I also I include Docker and Heroku and DigitalOcean and Google Cloud and all those options. So I've experienced all of the things. If I were to pick a number two, I would go with Heroku. I have had generally a very positive experience with integrating Pegasus with Heroku. I got good at running servers in my Domagi days. So I guess all of us are old enough that you know, PaaS probably didn't exist when we were first deploying applications. And so got comfortable on you know, sysadmining. And I feel like from a cost perspective, it's just like, it's so much nicer.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing when you're doing what solo projects, on one, cost actually matters
one box
more.
And it's running 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 projects, and it's not really a problem. And it's the same amount of money as it was when you were
running
one.
Yeah, if I were going to do the same thing on, you know, like Kubernetes or like, you know, DigitalOcean app platform or something, it would be like hundreds of dollars a month, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's interesting that DigitalOcean has a new app platform. Like, that's something I haven't played enough around with. Like, it seems like they're making a play at Heroku like simplicity. I have got my own deployment system that works, and I'm not a deployment engineer, so I'm just going to stick with it unless I have a reason to play around. I am going to use button.dev though. But aside from that, I'm not playing around with other stuff.
I'm excited to try button also.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, it's coming. It's very soon. Limitations of human power, but it's not far off now.
Well, there is, if people go to the website, Carlton, they can sign up on the list
to be notified. Dev, if you put your name in there, I'll email you quite soon. With, you know, hey, come on, early access, let me show you what it's how it works for me, and now I need to make it so that I can wrap up components for other people. It's that, you know, you're not going to have I don't want you running all my shell scripts.
Yeah, I would say one last thing. What you mentioned, Corey, about third-party projects, so I'm on version like 6 of my books, I think. You know, every Django version I update them, and I've just systematically taken out third-party stuff because, you know, it's just one more dependency and things change and there's problems. But OAuth and REST framework are, I think, the only two I still have in.
That makes sense.
Because they're, but it's been a long process of, you know, even what, and I guess Django, I use one for environment variables. I'm blanking on it. Django.env, one of those, I forget. I have an opinion I've written down somewhere, but I think those are the three. Because environment, those are very, and maybe Django database URL. That's kind of nice with Heroku.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I had a lot more. The first couple versions were more third-party things. And over time, it's like, we have crispy forums, which Carlton works on. So I guess maybe there's a half dozen, but there's definitely less than there were. Anyways. Well, thank you for taking the time, Corey. I know we've gone slightly over. We will have links to your personal site, to SAS Pegasus, Modern JavaScript Series, PlaceCardMe. Is there anything we didn't cover about your story or, you know, marketing that you want to get out there to people?
I feel good. Thanks for having me on. This was fun. It was nice to meet you both. I feel like I know your voices, but I had never know what you looked like.
Lovely to chat, to see your posts, see you on Twitter. I'm like, you know, who's this guy? So it's nice to, you know, see you in the face.
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate you writing those posts. I know I can understand, you know, both sides of thinking about whether you want to do it, but it's definitely helpful for those of us in a similar boat to share your story. So at least for the ones you've already written, I thank you for writing those.
You're welcome, and thanks for glad you're getting value, and I have fun with it, so I don't think I'll stop anytime.
Great. So we are at djangochat.com, chat Django on Twitter, and we'll see everyone next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.